Hi there, Jeb Sharp here. This is How We Got Here. Today we're delving into Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe has become totemic, not just in Africa, but in a wider context. I mean, it was seen as the big African success story originally. It was the country that was succeeding economically and politically. It had racial reconciliation before South Africa did its Rainbow Nation thing. And it's fallen from this peak right down into this trough of failed statehood. And its storyline is Shakespearean. It's an extraordinary, you know, everything is in there. And as a canvas, it's very vivid. It has this universal resonance, I think.
That's Peter Godwin. He's the author of the new book, The Fear, Robert Mugabe and the Martyrdom of Zimbabwe. Marco Werman interviewed him this week for The Big Show, and I'm including here the long, unedited version of the interview, which runs about 20 minutes. You regular listeners will know that's one of the prerogatives of this pod. I get to save material that would otherwise end up on the metaphorical cutting room floor and send it to your earbuds instead. I know I push the limits of what counts as history. This is very recent history, but I also think of my mandate as context as much as history, and this interview certainly gives context and texture to the drastic headlines we often see coming out of Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe. For those of you who are new to the pod, How We Got Here comes to you from PRI's The World, a.k.a. The Big Show. It's a public radio program about all things global. It's brought to you by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. We are online at theworld.org. You can subscribe to this pod through the links at theworld.org/history. Okay, back to Peter Godwin. He returned to his native Zimbabwe in 2008, thinking he was about to celebrate the ouster of Robert Mugabe in presidential elections.
There was this heady moment, this little window of opportunity that in the end lasted 2 or 3 weeks only, where it looked like Mugabe would recognize and accept the fact that he'd lost the election and would actually step down. He suddenly looked tired. He looked his age. I think he was then 84. And it looked like it was all over.
It wasn't all over, though. I mean, he stayed in power. He refused to leave.
No, and he didn't accept it in the end after consulting with his Politburo and probably more importantly, his generals. And I think that's one of the main points of departure, if you like, between what we have been seeing more recently in places like Tunisia and Egypt and even to some extent Libya and Zimbabwe. In Zimbabwe, if you try and have a mass protest, at the moment all such protests are illegal, but if you were to try and do that, then you wouldn't be able to put the stems of your flowers down the barrels of the soldiers' weapons because they'd be too busy firing live ammunition at you. And I think that's what we don't look at often enough in why, when we're discussing why did these uprisings now in North Africa succeed? Because what's really crucial is not just that they have the uprisings, which in some senses is surprising enough, but it's what decides, the main determinant of whether they're successful or not, is the reaction of the security forces. So, for example, the Egyptian army could have cleared Tahrir Square in an hour if they'd been of a mind to. But crucially, they weren't. And that's the main difference with Zimbabwe.
They would have come under enormous pressure and international reaction if they had, though, in Tahrir Square fired live ammunition on the people. And I suspect, wouldn't the same thing happen in Zimbabwe?
Up to a point. I mean, the Zimbabweans, you know, if you see what they did in 2008, where Mugabe launched a campaign of torture on an industrial scale, I mean, in the end, he more or less got away with that. He was sort of forced into a power sharing agreement. But he's very good. Mugabe is a very, very good manipulator of international opinion. I mean, even when he's seen now, you know, he's widely reviled, but he understands how to play particularly the Pan-African card very well. And in the region and in Africa, people are still scared of him, other heads of state and representatives in those organizations.
What do you mean by this fear, this violence, this intimidation on an industrial scale? I mean, you saw it up close in 2008.
I mean, I began to hear this word politicide to describe it, which is...
Politicide.
Politicide, yeah. Or as someone called it, smart genocide. I'm doing finger quotes. in the sense that, you know, what's changed since, for example, even since Rwanda, where, you know, 900,000, perhaps a million people were killed in that genocide... What Mugabe's learnt is that if you start killing people in those numbers, you do risk tipping over into a kind of sense of international revulsion where you do risk international intervention. So you don't need to kill hundreds of thousands of people anymore. You need to kill the right few hundred and scare the rest. And that's what he did. I mean, his militia and his party supporters and the army and police fanned out across the country, armed with lists of opposition office bearers at quite a modest level, at village and provincial level. And these opposition activists, they had their houses burnt, they were very savagely beaten, and they were taken away to these newly formed torture bases, which ironically were mostly sited in disused schools because the education system had completely collapsed by then. And they were run through these very routine torture. I mean, I spoke to so many torture victims, and by the end, I knew what they were going to say next because there was such a pattern to it. And it always incenses me when I hear the word anarchy uttered in the same sentence as Zimbabwe. It's many things, but anarchy is not one of them.
Well, you know, the New York Times today writes about the torture centers that Gaddafi operates in Libya. I mean, reading your book, The Fear, it's impossible not to see the obvious similarities. But it sounds like, from the way you describe it, Mugabe is actually much smarter than that.
Right. I mean, this was it was very systematic. And what he did was, these people, there were several hundred people killed, but for the most part, the people who'd been tortured, the torture victims, they were picked up and tortured on a catch and release basis, that they were then released back into their communities. They limped home and were pushed in wheelbarrows or whatever, these absolutely horrific injuries. And they acted in a sense like human billboards. I mean, that they were like advertisements for what happens with all the sort of political stigmata, what happens if you opposed his rule.
You know, we should remember that the protests across the Middle East all seem to start with a single fruit seller in a market in Tunis setting himself on fire. When you were in Zimbabwe, did you find anyone who would resort to something like that?
Well, that's a very good point. And crucially, Mugabe, a few years ago, carried out this thing called Operation Murat Zamvina, clear out the dirt. What they did was he went through the towns and cities and took all the informal traders and those, you know, sort of not even shanty towns, but anything that wasn't under his control, and broke all those houses and market stalls down and expelled those people out of the towns and cities precisely for that reason. And it was said at the time that Mengistu, who the
Haile Mariam of Ethiopia, you're right, I didn't know this, he's got a house in Zimbabwe.
Right, he went into exile after the Red Terror and after he was overthrown. He went into exile in Zimbabwe and lives in Harare. And it was said that he looked around and warned Mugabe that this is how it started going wrong in Ethiopia, and was one of the advisors behind that policy.
So, I mean, is the fear created by Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe just so much more profound than what you might find in, you know, Mubarak's Egypt?
I think it's probably more authoritarian now. I mean, it reminds me, you know, I used to be a correspondent in Eastern Europe before the wall came down, and it reminds me of the situation that pertained in some of those countries where there is this, it's almost been internalized. You know what I mean? If you scare people enough, you can almost get them to self-censor. And, you know, people know where the limits are, and most people are just trying to survive. Of course, the other thing you must remember with Zimbabwe, because it was the most literate country in Africa, and it's got this tremendously educated population, many, many of them have left. There's been this enormous exodus into the diaspora. And that's also one of the reasons you haven't seen uprisings, I think, because a lot of the sort of leadership echelon, a lot of the natural opposition supporters have voted with their feet and have left and gone to South Africa and Britain, America, all over the world, they've found out.
Peter, when you were in Zimbabwe, what do you think, what did you see that makes you kind of come to some conclusion about what motivates the gangs and henchmen who, you know, perpetrate the crimes on behalf of Robert Mugabe? Is it loyalty?
Well, yeah, I'm with Hannah Arendt on this, and the banality of evil. I think you always, when you see crimes of this stature, crimes against humanity, frankly, you expect the people committing them to be somehow more substantial. And the truth is that in my experience, the people actually committing them were often youths. They were often, you know, 16 or 17 years old. They were often stoned or high. They were unemployed. They were paid a little stipend, a dollar a day or something. They got a kind of status from it, swaggered around. And in my experience, what happens is that, you know, countries are like schoolyards. In any schoolyard, a bully will emerge if you allow him to. Mm. And it's about when a system collapses to the extent it's which bully happens to emerge is not necessarily the crucial thing. It's sort of it's Blakean. It's in the human heart. It's, you know, there it is. It's our baser nature. And when checks and balances break down, it's only a question of time as to, you know, who emerges. So I mean I did talk to these people, but by and large they were opportunists. They were, and some of them now, weirdly, some of those people who did the tortures are now turning up at these kind of counseling sessions, these self-counseling sessions, because some of them have been both on both sides of this. They've been both the victims and the perpetrators.
And what about Robert Mugabe himself? What continues to drive him, to motivate him at this point?
Well, I think if you've been a liberation leader, I mean, Mugabe's trajectory in terms of his image has been nothing short of extraordinary, if you think about it. He spends his early years being sort of feared by the West as a kind of communist, and feared by the white Rhodesians as that he'll bring in a racial vendetta. He comes in and does neither of those things. You know, in his own, at that time, he was like a prototype of Nelson Mandela when Nelson Mandela was still in prison, and you know, we hadn't heard from him for years and years, and he's lionized by the international community. He gets away with the Matabeleland massacres in 1983. Remember, probably 20,000 civilians killed then. But in those days, the West didn't care about that kind of thing. All we cared about during the Cold War was that you supported us rather than Moscow. So that's
and
what
the Matabeleland massacre was essentially a dissident uprising that he quashed very
right.
violently.
Well, there was a security problem, but in fact, what he did was he then set his North Korean trained 5th Brigade into the area, and those 20,000 were civilians. I mean, and that was much closer to a genocide. And it went on for some time, and there was almost no international reaction to it at all, because Mugabe, it didn't fit the script, if you know what I mean. Mugabe was a friend of the West by then. He wasn't kicking white farmers out. And also, the other smokescreen he had was that he was chairman of the frontline states opposing apartheid. So if you attacked Mugabe, he would always portray you as somehow defending apartheid. It was a very complex situation. But the key thing is that he spends all this time as a liberation leader. And it's very easy if you're a liberation leader, I think, to become messianic. And that's sort of what's happened to him. I think he's got this worldview that's almost religious. And you can almost see him. He seems perplexed. I mean, he's a very intelligent man, very good political operator and manipulator. But he knows enough to know that the real results of those elections was that there was a huge swing against him, even with all the cheating and the intimidation. But you can see him looking completely perplexed and saying, how can you vote against me? If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have a vote. You know, you can see that kind of messianic incomprehension coming across.
Peter Godwin, you write in The Fear about kind of a loneliness that exists at the top with Robert Mugabe. Elaborate on that a bit. Do you think, kind of like Laurent Gbagbo in Ivory Coast, that Mugabe just has so few options at this point to actually open the door of the presidential palace and walk out of the country? Maybe he's too scared to step away.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, the first thing to realize about Mugabe is that socially he's a loner. That he doesn't seem to have surround himself with kind of people that he can really talk to at that level. And secondly, in those first cabinets back in the 1980s, they were filled with his colleagues and his equals, and there was a kind of robust give and take in the debate. But slowly all those people have died or been fired, and now everybody in his cabinet and his Politburo, they're there because of him. They owe him their jobs. So nobody stands up to him. Nobody ever brings bad news to him or says the emperor has no clothes. So that's one way that his worldview gets, you know, as unrealistic worldview gets reinforced. As to his options, I mean, weirdly, The period I was talking about earlier in 2008, before the torture, he was being offered all sorts of deals, like Gbagbo is now. But at that time, the deals were quite easy to negotiate. I mean, all sorts of, you know, he would be the elder statesman, he wouldn't be prosecuted, he'd be given money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the torture changed everything, because now you've got this real, you know, moral stain. You've got this, you know, systematic human rights abuse. And in the old days, before the International Criminal Court was established, you know, the opposition could give guarantees against prosecution. But now they can't really. You know, you can run, but you can't hide. So I think that when he was ready to go, when he was wondering about going, that the generals pointed this out to him, that, you know, people would offer you various things, but they weren't in a position necessarily to guarantee your safety.
I want to ask you something, Peter, about your access when you were in Zimbabwe. I mean, it is pretty extraordinary, but then again, you grew up there. I mean, you knew people who were Mugabe's students when he was a school teacher. Most journalists, when they cover these situations, and from what we know about reporting on Zimbabwe in particular, they avoid using anyone's names. You mention names, people that you know, and it just why? I mean, isn't there the risk of reprisals?
Well, the truth is that the book was published after the establishment of this so-called government of national unity, where the opposition has been drawn into this very uncomfortable, it has to be said, kind of hybrid government. So the situation wasn't quite as bad as it had been when these events were taking place. However, you know, I gave options to people as I was talking to them, saying, you know, do you want me to change your name, whatever. And in most cases, surprisingly, people said no. They were proud of what they'd done, and they'd already, you know, the administration, Mugabe's regime, already knew who they were. They'd already been singled out. They wanted it, you know, they wanted to talk. And I think that, you know, it's important to respect that as well, and not to somehow infantilize people by saying, "Well, I know better." You know, this is what they wanted, and this is what I did. You know, there are occasionally people in the book who didn't want to be identified, and I didn't identify them. But by and large, I think there's also safety in numbers. I think that, you know, that self censorship that I was talking before, that's the dictator's friend.
Peter, The Fear is a powerful and personal piece of reporting. So let me end by asking you a personal question. I mean, so much of the Zimbabwe narrative has been about black and white. Your family's fortunes, as a result, have risen and fallen. And now whites in Zimbabwe, I guess it's fair to say, are kind of like second-class citizens. Do you ever kind of just feel like, to hell with Zimbabwe and Mugabe, you know, I'll just find some place where I don't have that burden?
Absolutely, on a daily basis. I mean, you know, it's. I'm as surprised as anybody that I'm still writing about Zimbabwe all these years. But it's a very curious place. It's much bigger than the sum of its parts. Zimbabwe has become totemic, not just in Africa, but in a wider context. I mean, it was seen as the big African success story originally. It was the country that was succeeding economically and politically. It had racial reconciliation before South Africa did its Rainbow Nation thing, and it's fallen from this sort of this peak right down into this trough of failed statehood. And its storyline is, I mean, it's Shakespearean. It's an extraordinary, you know, everything is in there. And as a canvas, it's very vivid. It has this universal resonance, I think, and it's very hard to turn away from. It's a place I know very well, and so it does keep drawing me back. And I think also there's a kind of sense of sadness and loss of exile I've noticed, that, you know, in America, for example, you can tell the difference between immigrants and exiles, people who've come here looking for just a better life and economic opportunity, as opposed to people who have been chased from their countries and kind of are perennially homesick.
I mean, this is your third book on Zimbabwe. How do you continue to kind of reconcile with what's going on there?
Well, it keeps changing. I mean, it's extraordinary. You keep thinking the story is sort of over, and it's not. I mean, this book, it has to be said, was an accidental book. I mean, insofar as I didn't set out to write it. I mean, I went there originally on an assignment, you know, for a magazine, for Vanity Fair, to do a particular piece. But then the story just went off in this extraordinary direction. And I then realized very early on, when I was taking all this testimony, that I had notebooks and notebooks full of these most extraordinary stories. And I realized very quickly that I had a kind of obligation. I've said in the book that I'd always been rather allergic to the phrase bearing witness, thinking it was somewhat pretentious. But I realized at the time there were no other foreign correspondents there. They'd all been kicked out. The NGOs had mostly been sort of closed down or hamstrung, curtailed. Much of the opposition leadership at the top had fled. And I just felt the longer I was there recording this, I really had a duty to write about it.
Well, you certainly did bear witness by telling extraordinary stories. Peter Godwin's just written The Fear, Robert Mugabe and the Martyrdom of Zimbabwe. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And thanks to both Peter and Marco. If you found that conversation riveting, I think it's safe to say the book is even more so. Let us know what you think at the How We Got Here Facebook page or at theworld.org/history. Also, keep the program ideas coming. Jonathan Connors suggests one looking at parallels between the Arab uprisings and those in Eastern Europe in 1989. And I'm also looking for good Japan ideas. I'm very conscious we haven't done anything yet on the History Pod. So send your historical questions about Japan, whether they're about natural disasters there or nuclear dangers or relevant Japanese politics, whatever. I'm on Twitter at Jeb Sharp. You can also reach me on email, howwegothere@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I will speak to you soon.